So this isn't our planned episode.
No, it's not, is it?
Obviously, this week, the world got a little bit darker. We lost Brian Wilson, co-founder of the Beach Boys, an incredible human being. And he could quite possibly be this universe's anchor being, but we're yet to see.
Okay, that's so bold.
Yeah.
Right.
So we thought we'd take this opportunity to celebrate him, his work, and what he did for us. We're talking Love and Mercy, 2014. I'm Ben Groves.
I'm Rob McFarlane.
And welcome to the Every Movie Ever Podcast! But before we get to the what we're doing,
yeah,
let's just get to the important question. How are you doing, buddy?
I'm good. I was having a great week. Mm-hmm. You were having a melt.
Yeah.
So I got to do my favourite thing, play nurse. I was like buying your DVDs to cheer up.
You bought me some DVDs. They are very good.
And then I encountered my own issue in that all the wedding bands in Shropshire decided to hold a festival at the other end of my high street.
Yeah.
And the lovely Victorian barn that I live in, that when it thunderstorms, you can hear every drop of rain.
It's gorgeous.
Now I'm just hearing every bad cover of Purple Rain.
Yeah.
And it's murdering me.
Yeah.
And yesterday I was having like a visceral physical stress response about 10 hours in.
Yeah.
And you sorted me out with some Brian Wilson, actually, which does make me feel bad about this, because I'm aware that you've prepped an episode very much about the man, the celebration of the man, and how much he's meant to you. And I worry that this is going to undercut this. Okay. How many Brian Easters does it take to change a light bulb?
I don't know.
Three.
Why?
One to change it.
Yeah.
One to praise Brian Wilson for the gift of light.
Right.
And one to blame Mike for the old bulb going out. How about you, babe?
Yeah, it's good. I'm not going to lie, mate. I've had one of the longest weeks of my entire life.
Yeah.
And then Brian Wilson dies. So I'm sad as fuck.
Yep.
But I'm using this as an opportunity to go through all the old memories that the Beach Boys were there for.
People who aren't your best mate might not know how much Brian Wilson meant to you, but it's fine. We're going to explain that. Okay. So if you're confused as to why Ben is sad that this old rocker has died, I'm gonna relentlessly bully him while he becomes vulnerable.
I need this, because otherwise I'm just going to end up fucking crying for an hour, and I can't do it.
Yeah, exactly.
You know what I mean? I've had a few days of that. I can't be doing that again. It's weird now. But I'm also using this opportunity to go through like the entire discography of the Beach Boys again.
Mint.
Which I fucking adore.
Mm-hmm.
I've been sending you albums daily.
To be fair, when I was having a mini meltdown yesterday because my home had turned into like the worst wedding through a wall ever. Yeah, yeah.
There's only so many times you can hear Footloose done badly. You know what I mean?
It's playing right now. For those that don't know, we're recording this on the Sunday of the same festival. So I had a meltdown yesterday because it was noisy.
Mm-hmm.
And then we went, let's record the episode on Sunday, not realizing
day two
that Mediocrity Anonymous were going to be held in their convention at the top of the road.
Yeah.
So you sent me Surf's Up.
I did.
And it was like an aspirin for my heart. It calmed me right down.
That album, whenever I'm getting like overstimulated or I'm having a wobble or anything like this, that album, it just goes on start to finish, and you just get like Brian Wilson being desperately sad and Carl Love trying desperately to cheer him up. Yeah. It's like the most gorgeous balance.
Let's get into the healing journey, shall we?
I'm down for it, man. I'm down for it. Let's sum up the show a little bit, right? We're going to be getting into why this film covers periods of time in the 60s and the 80s, but ignores the 70s.
What Brian Wilson and his wife Melinda Ledbetter think of this film.
How accurate Love and Mercy is as a representation of Brian Wilson's life.
And finally, we're going to answer the real question. What's this film really about?
What is this film really
about?
I've got some stuff on this. I've got a bunch of stuff, but I've written the breakdown first. Now, this is a moment where we take a couple minutes just for people that haven't seen the film, people that aren't planning on watching it, even though at this point in my fragile emotional state,
if
anyone ever turns around and says, nah, I'm not going to watch it, you are on a list.
Right, okay. Yeah,
You've made my list.
Yeah.
I don't know what that list is, but it's not a Christmas card list, and you shan't be getting one, good sir. All right? Like, go watch it. It's a gorgeous, gorgeous film. Incredible depiction of Brian Wilson and the story of the Beach Boys making Pet Sounds right through to the 80s. It's incredible. Go and watch it. We're going to break down the film. I've written this one.
I feel like the spoilers tag, however, is when it's a biopic.
Exactly.
Do you know what I mean?
It doesn't really need to exist, because if you're a fan of the Beach Boys and you know a bit of Brian Wilson,
you know what happens in this film, right?
Yeah, yeah, yeah. You know the film.
No one sat down to watch Titanic going, I bet this is going to go great.
Oh, yeah. Apparently, this turns out incredible.
Right.
Yeah, yeah. Like,
you know the ending when you get into the film.
100%.
I'm going to start us off. In the 1960s, Brian Wilson is at the height of fame with the Beach Boys, but the pressures of touring and the growing complexity of his musical vision begin to weigh heavily on him. Choosing to stay home while the band tours, Brian focuses on creating Pet Sounds, driven by a desire to innovate and express something deeper. His brilliance in the studio is undeniable, but so is his growing fragility. Yeah, it's a bit like Ben. He's plagued by anxiety. Oh, hang about, yeah. Mm-hmm. Auditory hallucinations, nearly. Mm-hmm. And self-doubt every day. Every day.
Yeah, put some effort into this one. Jumping forward to the 1980s, we meet an older, broken Brian under the suffocating care of Dr. Eugene Landy, a manipulative therapist who controls nearly every aspect of his life. Brian, now medicated and withdrawn, meets Melinda Ledbetter, a car saleswoman who sees past his erratic behavior and senses something is deeply wrong.
I thought you were going to say a Carl Sagan then.
Yeah, I said Carl. I'm thinking of Carl Love. It's my bad. As their relationship grows, Melinda becomes increasingly alarmed by Landy's domination. Meanwhile, flashbacks to the 60s show Brian descending further into paranoia, with studio scenes giving way to isolation and mental collapse. Both timelines converge in portraying Brian as a man lost inside his own mind and under the control of others.
Melinda takes a stand against Landy's hold on Brian, risking her own safety and career to expose the unethical guardianship. With persistence and legal action, she helps free Brian from Landy's influence, and the film closes on a note of cautious hope. Brian, though still fragile, begins to reclaim his autonomy and rebuild his life, both personally and musically. Love, in the form of Melinda's compassion and courage, offers him a kind of mercy that years of fame and treatment never did.
So that was the plot breakdown.
Yeah.
And now I'm going to have an emotional breakdown. Because I wrote
you
that.
Before you do, I have known you 15 years.
18 years.
18 years.
None taken.
I round up to meaning, you know, that entire time you've been a Beach Boys obsessive. And I always kind of understood it as Brian Wilson writes very hopeful, very comforting music.
Yeah.
Which, when you have a spicy childhood, can be quite a kind of comfort, right?
Calming place.
It's a nice place
to sort of retreat to.
And the same day he died, you came round to mine and we watched Love and Mercy.
Yeah.
And just
fucking
melted.
Cried. Just fucking broke. Yeah.
Which I kind of was like, is this the right thing to do? And I think it was. I think it was a necessary purge.
By the end of it, I was like, what a fucking glorious human.
Yeah.
What an absolute celebration of this man's life. It's easy to sort of be sad and focus on the fact that he's no longer here and that the world is a different place now, right? Or we can take a minute and really like dig into all the good stuff and all the positives and all the fun and love and everything that he brought to everyone.
Right. So the good news is when you well up, I've got a series of terrible, terrible Brian Wilson jokes.
This is going to be great. Yeah. Right. How many have you got? You need a lot.
So I ran out of time. I've got two. I've already used, I had four, but I've used two already.
Okay.
But that's fine. We've moved on already. I can see, I'm going to save them.
Okay.
You know, they're my in case of emergency break last.
Cool.
This film's great.
Fucking incredible.
The performances
right?
are insane. Mm-hmm. I was a little bit worried because I'm not a massive Beach Boys fan. I know vaguely. Yeah. You might not know this. New listeners won't know this. And old listeners probably not either because I never really talk about it. But I used to work in the music industry.
Fuck off.
And there's a bunch of like legendary anecdotes that when you're sitting around doing a rail off a midget, you sort of chat about, right? When
sure.
itching your teeth. Mm-hmm. And Brian Wilson's story of like musical genius to filling the studio with sand
yeah.
that the cat started using as litter boxes
yeah.
and then becoming a recluse is like one of the famous ones. And it's not from a place of love. It's very much from a place of like, he's a nutter.
Yeah.
Coming into it from that perspective, I thought this was going to be really cynical.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought it was going to be, there's a great word, hagiography, right?
Okay.
Right. Hagiography is the autobiography of a saint. It's a word that doesn't need to exist. It's a word I know. You can just say autobiography of a saint.
Yeah.
But if you write an autobiography of a saint, it gets a new noun, which is hagiography. And right. I've always used it as a kind of slur for biopics that paint the person they're about as a faultless wonder.
Dude.
Who never, like, if they ever do a James Brown biopic and it's not the history of a violent drug addict
oh, yeah,
who happened to be good at dancing and singing, it's going to be a hagiography. You can't just whitewash the truth. And I was really worried it was going to be that.
I also got scared of this, right? I saw this film when it first came out, but it was when I was very much a lover of weed.
You were a friend of Mary.
I was a friend of Mary.
Something about the films you bring to the podcast kind of tells the audience implicitly, subtly, that you used to like weed.
That I used to do drugs.
Right, if you've seen Tammy and the T-Rex, it's mint.
Me and my one friend from college were massive fans of the Beach Boys, like huge. So obviously when a Beach Boys movie comes out, everyone's like, oh, hello. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, of course.
Oh, hello. So we all get together, get stoned.
Yeah.
Listen to a bunch of records.
Yeah.
And then end up falling asleep to Love and Mercy.
Right.
And I was like, oh, what a wonderful little slice of Beach Boys that was. But in all fairness, I was high as fuck and it was mainly eyes shut listening to listening to that. Yeah. It was completely lost on me back then. It was just another bit of fan service for Beach Boys fans, which is what I took it as, and it was fine. And then we watched it on Wednesday, the day that Brian Wilson passed.
Right.
And it was a whole different movie.
I mean, the performances in this, just off the bat,
dude,
the performances in this are mind-blowing. Paul Dano, yet again, proving that he is on route to be the American Gary Oldman.
It's unreal. I would say that if we look at Gary Oldman when he was Paul Dano's age, they're sort of neck and neck right now. I think he's going to be...
Because Oldman was doing Leon.
He's well on his way. He's well on his way to that sort of like status up there. John Cusack kind of caught me off guard in this one a little bit.
I'd say the first 10% of this movie, John Cusack's performance. You know, in Tropic Thunder,
they've
got the famous conversation where Tug Speedman, the action star, has done a film called Simple Jack, right? And it's flopped. It's flopped at the box office. And Robert Downey Jr.'s character, the dude playing a dude who's pretending to be a dude.
You're about to quote the movie. This isn't your words. This is from a script.
I'm not
going to
quote
the
movie fully.
Oh, no?
But he's like, you went full hard R.
Oh, okay.
Right?
Yeah, sure.
The first 10% of this film, it feels a little bit like the first 10% of John Cusack's performance has gone full hard R.
Mm-hmm.
Right? And you're like, oh, no.
He might have gone a little bit too, a little bit extra.
But then over the duration of the movie, it kind of locks in.
And you get a bit of context.
Oh.
Yeah.
That's why.
Yeah. So this is the whole thing. It was a little bit jarring to start with. And I was like, oh, hello.
Right.
Oh, hello.
Because it becomes apparent that Eugene Landy is basically stuffing him with enough ketamine to fill a rhinoceros.
Fucking evil.
Yeah.
Fucking evil.
And kind of using his position as a way of medicating Brian into medicating him into a way where he can get legal guardianship and kind of steal the proceeds of the estate and have his own little pet Brian Wilson to make sense.
Yeah, 100%. He was a meal ticket for Eugene
Landy. But until the movie reveals that he's drugged off his tits, you just think, oh no, Cusack's overcooked it.
Yeah. And you're sort of like, oh, that was a take. And that was left in. And like literally, like the car dealership, I was like, wow,
that's a strong take.
I loved
you, Jenny Cadillac.
That's something. That is something. But then as the film progresses, you get the context surrounding as to why the performance is the way it is. And when this context sort of develops around it, it could not be more perfect.
Oh yeah, 100%.
It could not be more perfect. You see, Paul Dano is the absolute titan of what I would call a juxtaposition between the 80s broken man and the 60s hopeful teetering on destruction. You know what I mean?
Dano's got the face for it, though. Dano's got one of those faces that is so full of innocence that the second you throw a bit of sadness in his eyes,
fucking
you're like, oh, God.
Little Miss Sunshine, dude.
It's that. They went, right, who can we cast as Brian Wilson? I don't know. The man who looks exactly like him and has done a performance in Little Miss Sunshine.
Yeah.
That basically he just needs to do over 90 minutes.
he broke everyone's heart in that one film a while ago.
And we've loved him ever since.
And he wasn't even the suicidal one in that film. And he still managed to break everyone's heart for it. And you're like, how? How? So casting him in this role was an insane choice, and it was incredible. I've seen a few interviews with Paul Dano, and he was like, this is the most exciting role that he's ever been able to get into prep for. Obviously, he was sent to go hang out with Brian Wilson.
Oh,
and he got access to music of the sessions, you know, like from like when they were recording Pet Sounds, and they get all these like little tidbits of The scene in the movie where Brian Wilson is putting hairpins.
Yeah, little bobby pins on the strings of the piano so he can pluck the plectrums from guitars.
In the Smile sessions, when he was recording piano, he's inside a piano and there's a whole recording thing.
So that's like a Taken From Life thing.
It's all of it's Taken From Life.
Hey!
Paul Dano was sent to hang out with Brian Wilson, as was John Cusack. And they both said almost identical things. They rock up to his house.
Yeah.
They knock on the door and it's Melinda, his wife, is in the kitchen.
Yeah.
There's like five or six kids running around. There's dogs everywhere. There's this, that, and the other. And everyone's just sort of like, yeah, he's just upstairs chilling out. Go find him. It's all this, that, and the other. A house full of laughter and love and all this stuff. And they come away from this being sort of like, okay, I need to portray this now. I need to get this going, which is fucking incredible. The one person that has like fucked me up a little bit in this film, Paul Giamatti, playing Eugene Landy.
I mean, Giamatti's going to Giamatti. Do you know what I mean?
I've got a quote from Brian Wilson.
Right.
Right? Just let me find it real quick. So the quote from Brian Wilson talking about Giamatti is, he scared me.
Right.
I felt very vulnerable and open. And seeing Landry on screen, just know that in real life, it was much worse.
Ooh.
Yeah. So in this film, Eugene Landy is a teddy bear compared to what he was doing to Brian Wilson in real life.
Right. I mean, as somebody who is violently conflict averse and not confident and all this kind of stuff in lots of ways. Okay. Like if I feel safe, I become the most overconfident motherfucker you've ever seen.
Oh, yeah, yeah. I see it daily.
Right. But if there's even a whiff of conflict, I get back in my box mad quick.
Right.
And I kind of see the stuff that Eugene Landy is portrayed doing in this. And I'm like, yeah, I'd stay.
Yeah. It's.
I can't imagine what it's like to. It's an interesting thing that happens a couple of times. Happened with Shia LaBeouf's Honey Boy, where Shia LaBeouf had to play his own abusive father. I'm like,
100%.
I can't imagine seeing a film of the worst moments in my life.
So this is it, man. So obviously, Brian Wilson's father was very abusive, emotionally, physically, insanely manipulative.
Yeah, because in the film it says he can't hear out of one ear because of his dad smacking him like Mozart. Beethoven, sorry.
Yeah, he got belted in the ear and was 96% deaf.
Jesus.
In his one ear because of this. Horribly abusive father. There is so much to get into there. That's a whole episode on its own.
Is that why all the Beach Boys records are mono?
Hilarious. Brutal, but hilarious. So Landry is hired by his first wife.
Right.
During the mid-70s, when he's at his like worst point, like absolute worst point. There's no sort of getting him out of bed or functioning or anything like this. He's just gone. He's hired by his first wife to sort of fix him up. He gets diagnosed as wrongly diagnosed as paranoid schizophrenic.
I mean, he definitely had something going on because he was hearing
clinical depression.
Right. But drug you addiction. Don't hallucinate. Oh, well, I suppose drug use. Yeah.
Yeah. Loads of drug use. He fucking loved LSD.
I mean, who doesn't?
It's fine. Mushrooms are better. But Landry was hired, was fucking awful, made him 10 times worse,
right?
And then was fired, right?
Yeah.
Brian comes back, starts making music again, gets even worse than before, and is on like path to pure destruction, like literally just crashing out hard. Landry is hired again, this time given way more control.
Right.
The legal guardian, do the whole thing. This is you. They essentially signed Brian Wilson over to to Eugene Landry.
So he's kind of, Eugene Landry's kind of like the OG Britney's dad.
Kind of.
Yeah.
I think Brian Wilson's dad is the OG Britney's dad, to be honest.
Okay, fair. Yeah. But the whole kind of legal guardianship, you know, removing somebody's ability to express themselves freely and you know,
so Landry,
terrifying.
Yeah, so Landry saw Brian Wilson as like a meal ticket, right?
Right.
He was literally, because he wanted to be in showbiz before he became a doctor, air quotes, doctor.
Yeah, because he talks about the book that he wrote and the
Urban Dictionary and all this shit. And it's like, what are you doing?
Right.
Anyway, he wanted to be in show business. He wanted to be famous. Brian Wilson's his meal ticket. He used to get treated like a rock star because if you wanted to get to Brian Wilson or anything to do with new music or new Beach Boys or anything like this, you had to go through him.
Right.
So it was this all overbearing, overpowering, all controlling relationship that he had, but it was so reminiscent of the time he had with his father that Brian Wilson saw him as a father figure.
Ew.
Now I've got a quote here from Brian Wilson.
Right.
Okay. So this is the quote.
Right.
I still feel that there was a benefit. I try to overlook all the bad stuff and be thankful for what he taught me. What person in this world would be treated in such a horrendous way where he was cut off from his family, cut off from his friends, even Melinda, when he was dating Melinda, Landry was there actively trying to keep Melinda away and do this, that, and the other, threatening legal action left, right, and center. The most heinous human being you can think of. And Brian Wilson still turns around and goes, I'm just happy for all the lessons that he taught me, man. You know what I mean? It's we can look over the bad stuff, we can forgive the bad stuff, and we can just move on and look. What the fuck? What the fuck kind of person?
I think it's every person who's healed. And I'll qualify that.
Okay.
How many people have you and I known, dated, right, who still carry hate for the people that have hurt them in the past? And all it does is keep them unwell.
Yeah.
Like every healed person I know who's moved forward has gone, that was awful. That was the worst thing in my life.
Yeah.
And the person who did it to me, I've let it go.
Because
if you don't let it go, you just hold on to it and it festers.
Yeah, of course.
And the number of people I've known who you get a few drinks in them and they're furious about the things that have been done to them. And I'm like, of course, all of this is awful.
Yeah, yeah.
And of course, you that person doesn't deserve forgiveness. But you do. You deserve to forgive them so 100%. That you can move forward with your life outside of the rubble.
But what a lesson to learn
from Brian Wilson,
from the Beach Boys, you know, California Girls, Lil Deuce Coupe. And then he's dropping bombs like this after being horridly abused for a decade.
A full decade's a bit.
This is what I mean. So the film actually touches on this. The film covers the 60s, which is when Brian Wilson started getting the big panic attacks and the mental breakdowns.
Yes.
So anxious that he stopped touring with the Beach Boys.
Right.
Sent the Beach Boys off to Japan to do their tour and do this thing. You know, you guys are going to kill it. Just, just miss me when you're gone. And he's super positive about it all. He's super lovely about everything. He stays at home and he starts working on music, which is the Pet Sounds, right? Mm-hmm. Pet Sounds album. And the film sort of focuses in on this process where we get to witness a little bit of behind the scenes of how Brian Wilson worked and how his creative process came to be, which was fucking glorious. And again, Paul Dano, insane.
Nails it.
Insane.
Nails it.
All the musicians in that segment are real musicians.
They really are. They really are. So there's one who I was so happy to see, right? So she's a little blonde bass player with funky 60s glasses.
I thought you'd
glasses.
Pick up on this. Yeah, yeah.
Carol Kay, right? Yeah. Carol Kay, I don't know. So for a bit of context, you might not know this, but I used to work in the music industry.
Oh, you haven't mentioned it.
Right,
that's
no,
crazy.
I know. And Carol Kay was one of those kind of like music makers.
Yeah.
In that she is probably the most recorded bass player. So
right.
There's always like, who's the most recorded? So I think Josh Freese is the most recorded drummer.
Okay.
He's played with every 2000s era rock band you care to think of.
Yeah,
he was a member of A Perfect Circle for a while. He was a member of Nine Inch Nails for a while. He was a member of Sum 41 for a while. And everything in between those spectrums.
Right.
So it's a lot.
Yeah.
Carol Kay is the 50s and 60s version of Josh Freese. So she has played on an estimated 10,000 recordings.
Fucking hell.
Right. Over 65 years. The original theme to Mission Impossible.
Yeah.
That's her on bass.
No way.
The soundtrack for Bullet.
Steve McQueen movie.
Yeah. That's her on bass.
I'm fucking obsessed with that movie at the minute.
Right?
That's insane.
Quick list of artists that she's played with. Frank Sinatra, Simon and Garfunkel, Stevie Wonder, Barbara Streisand, The Supremes, The Temptations, The Four Tops, The Monkees, The Beach Boys. These Boots Are Made for Walking.
Nancy Sinatra.
That's her on bass.
No fucking way, man.
Ain't no mountain high enough.
Yeah.
Remember the sick intro to that?
Yeah.
That's her on bass.
Fucking amazing.
And the best thing is, she didn't think anything she did was going to be remembered. Because when she was recording pop music, it was in its first 10 years when everyone thought it was going to be a phase.
Right.
Do you remember when like pop punk was a thing?
Yeah.
Imagine if that was then the default genre now.
No.
right, exactly.
No. That's good when I was 14.
Right.
When I'm 36.
But this is how they all felt about what they were working. I've got a point about that later. This film is filled with juicy little eggs of like, if you know, you know.
This is it, man. So in the 60s, you've got all of this timeline going on. You've got this big moment, this huge moment, this defining moment in musical history.
Pet Sounds being recorded.
Where one of the greatest albums of all time is being cooked up in Brian Wilson's head. And he's in a room full of people going, hey, can we get dogs in here?
Yeah.
Hey, do you think we can get a horse in here?
Yeah.
And then we fast forward to the 80s, which is a whole different era in the Brian's life. Because at this point, the Beach Boys is still a thing, but they're sort of, there's been a decade of turbulence, right?
Back in the old days, this is a bit personal, but I used to work in the music industry. And
no way, man.
The thing that we used to say was that every artist gets 5 years.
Okay.
So the average lifespan of an artist at the top is 5 years. Mm-hmm. So you'll have your big breakthrough album.
Got you.
And after about 5 years, no matter what you do,
yeah,
it will become absorbed and it will become known.
Yeah.
And people will go, oh, that old shit. Which is why Bowie was so successful, because he would wait to the end of the 5 years and then he would do something entirely different, but just as artistically valid and, importantly, just as entertaining.
Yeah, of course.
And it feels like Brian Wilson was consistently trying to do that and everyone else was going, no, no, we'll die if you let us do that. Yeah, we should stay exactly the same.
So that's the start of it, where everyone was like, we need to stick to our platinum records. Yeah. We need to stick to the surf pop and this, you know, the cars, the chicks,
which
the surfing.
Which was definitely going to stay platinum in 1978.
Do you see what I mean?
Like, so, God Save the Queen's out and they're like, come surfing with us.
There you go. That's what it is. His personal struggles through the 70s. He was in bed for 4 years, which
Sorry,
is like...
For what?
For 4 years, right? So this is like a common anecdotal story that's told about Brian Wilson. Oh, he was so depressed and he was so ill.
Right.
He was in bed for 4 years. He wasn't in bed for 4 years. He slept through the day.
Right.
And then went out at night sometimes.
Right.
For about 4 years.
Okay.
Where he was massively into drugs.
Right.
He was suffering horrendously with depression.
Right.
He ballooned to like 300 pounds.
Oh.
Couldn't function properly as a human being, right?
Okay.
He's mentioned it in interviews and stuff before. He says, I was a terrible father. Mm-hmm. He mentions it in the film. I was drinking and drugging. Terrible father. Yeah. I should have been there for my kids, but I wasn't. There's some anecdotes that are still told today where he offered heroin to his 10-year-old daughter.
Jesus!
Whilst he was in a depressive episode. And that's sort of like the point where his first wife left him. And it's understandably so.
There's a level of fuck it that you have to arrive at in your life to offer heroin to a child.
I think you have to be pretty fucking deep in a hole.
Right.
You know what I mean? You have to
for that to be a rational thing to do.
Yeah, exactly.
Where nothing matters, not even the future life of your child.
100%. So he understands all of this. He doesn't shy away from any of it either. He like talks about all of his flaws like they're part of him, because they are.
Yeah.
And you can see it in his lyrics where he'll address certain things. Mm-hmm. Obviously not trying to feed his 10-year-old heroin, but he addresses certain things like regrets and everything like this and how he deals with it.
Do we think the band helped here? Because they were constantly offering to get around.
They did.
So he was struggled with his sobriety.
Yeah.
It's only because the barman ran.
Mm-hmm. That was very good. That was very good. I'm not going to lie, I hated it.
Yeah,
it's very good.
These jokes are designed, right?
Go on.
I can't cheer you up, but I can use your anger to pull you up. When I see the eyes get a bit glassy,
that's pulled it. Yeah,
I'm,
that's good.
I'm hoping that you can rise on the rage bubble.
Yeah,
use the rage bubble like a hot air balloon.
This is a magician.
And you're back in the room.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. Street magician, snap, you're back in the room. There you go, Rob McFarlane, the great Martellini.
Oh.
But there's this whole thing. He used to wander through town in a bathrobe.
Iconic.
Wandering into bars, playing
at
the piano
pounds.
At 300 pounds in a bathrobe.
Just a fat, undressed man in
playing
a bathrobe.
Playing a piano for cigarettes and drinks. That is Brian Wilson of the Beach Boys wandering LA, going into a bar and going, hey, can I play piano for a bit? You can pay me in cigarettes and a couple of whiskeys. That's fucking insane to me. But this is why it's omitted from the movie. So we see the before and we see the after, but the during, I think, would have been literal torture porn.
I think it's
for the mentally unwell.
I think it's a classier film for not showing that, because
100%.
Otherwise it becomes exploitative.
Exactly.
And it becomes circus sideshow.
This is
why.
And
I don't think there's anything particularly useful sort of going, look at how bad he got. It works as a warning to people who've never tried a drug in their life.
Oh, 100%.
And never had a mental health episode in their life.
Yeah.
But when you're at that point, all it does is validate.
It does.
All it does is validate.
It's
not just me.
Yeah.
It's not just me down here.
See,
Brian Wilson
thing.
Was down here too. I'm basically Brian Wilson.
There's things in there for that. Yeah. There's stuff like this. That exact fact there is why this film took 19 years to get made.
Right, because
Everyone wanted to do the Beach Boys. Everyone wanted to do the Brian Wilson story. But Melinda Ledbetter and Brian Wilson were like, the right one.
Right, yeah. Can we be a bit classy about it?
The right one will do. And it will be made, but you know, there's no. It took 19 years to find the right script and the right story and the right people to tell this story.
Of course,
I think they did, because the director, Bill Pollard.
Bill Pollard, yeah.
Bill Pollard.
I had no idea how it's pronounced.
Yeah, same.
Pohlahd.
I don't know.
It's Something like that.
You're asking a dyslexic to spell. It's fucking it's just bullying at this point, you know what I mean? They pitched the idea to the writer, Oren Moverman.
Sorry?
Oren Moverman.
Posh parents.
That's his name.
Hippie parents.
There you go. So it was pitched to him. He then turned around and was like, okay, let me get into it. I'll get the research and stuff done.
Uh-huh.
And this is a quote from Oren Moverman about writing this film with the idea of it mm-hmm. being true to the story and entertaining for the big screen, right?
Right.
We were very aware of the big screen, of the theatrical experience. What we wanted to do was sort of an immersive film that lets you experience certain elements because you can't tell the whole story. It's too much of a story.
Yep.
Actually, the first draft that I wrote was almost 170 pages long, and I felt that that was too short. I remember sending an email to Bill, the director,
yeah.
saying, here's the first draft attached. I feel it's too short. It had over 100 songs and 170 pages, and I just felt like I didn't do the story justice. So we had a long conversation where he basically said, well, you've done 150%. I need you to do 100%. Which is great.
That's fantastic.
To have someone look at a story overall mm-hmm. and go, I don't think I'm doing it justice. And over fucking egg the bread right. so much so that it's like, you've got a film and a half.
Right.
Incredible.
It's very easy with something as popularly known and something as kind of as universally regarded as a Beach Boys story or something like this to kind of overcook it and overcare.
Yeah, and definitely.
Like Bohemian Rhapsody for me is a classic example of a terrible biopic.
I don't like biopics, man. Biopics and
done right, they're incredible. Done right, they're incredible.
Yes, done like this.
But the vast majority of them are not. And the vast majority of them are not because they become, word of the week, hagiographies,
mm-hmm.
where everyone's so reverent and they try and cover so much they try and kind of build it into this epic rather than just being, here's a person that lived, which is all it needs to be.
This is all it is, man.
Parts of this film that I think work really well. So, for instance, Carl Love.
Yeah.
I think it's a really good portrayal of what it's actually like when somebody plays you something that could be ahead of its time.
Are you on about Mike Love?
Sorry, Flat Mike Cap. Love. Yeah. I'm not. Yeah. So Flat Cap Man.
Yeah.
Mike Love.
Yeah.
Throughout all this film, he is Captain Naysayer, Captain, you don't know what you're doing. You're going to destroy the band. And I don't know enough about the real guy to be able to say if this is fair or not. But I don't know if you know this, but I used to work in the music industry.
Oh, no way.
And well, here's the thing. The difficult thing with genius musicianship
mm-hmm.
is if it is truly ahead of its time, that means it sounds like shit to everyone who isn't also on that wavelength.
Yeah.
Like, if you played, it's Back to the Future. I guess you're not ready for that yet, right?
Your kids are going to love it.
If you're there doing that solo,
mm-hmm.
everyone else in the room is going, are you a fucking mental?
Yeah.
It's very easy to, with hindsight, go back and go, see, he was right all along. But here's the thing. I've been in the room with probably closing in about 100 artists who are trying something new
mm-hmm.
and think it's going to be appreciated later.
Yeah.
And it bounces off the public like a cotton ball off a tank.
Yeah.
I won't name them here because I'm of a course. Gentleman, but like, ask me in the Discord.
Sure.
That we have a little private chat room on Discord. Yeah, join it up now. And I could probably, the top of my head, list 10 acts that I've worked with
mm-hmm.
who did a great album.
Yeah.
If you're a proper music listener and you really know your beans and you've listened to music and you do active listening and you're a music obsessive, are great albums that sank like a stone.
Yeah.
Because at the end of the day, it is a numbers game. And the vast majority of the audience do not love music.
Yeah.
They like music.
Yeah.
The vast majority of the audience buy 2 albums a year. They buy an Adele album, they buy a Sam Smith album, except not anymore because he's gone weird, and they go, I love music.
Yeah.
But then you say, oh, what are your thoughts on this album, that album? Haven't heard them. They don't bother. You say, what do you listen to? They're like, oh, a bit of everything.
Yeah, I buy my CDs from Starbucks.
Right. And before you think that that's a criticism, it's not.
No, definitely
not. It's totally
not.
Fine. They are getting as much love out of music as they see returned to them.
Yeah, of course.
So when you have an album like Pet Sounds, right? And it's made not only by somebody who mm-hmm. is soaked in music, but for people who are quite damp themselves.
Yeah.
And you're then saying, we're going to sell this to the bone dry general public.
Yeah.
To see Mike in this film,
mm-hmm.
have that chat.
Yeah.
Fully on board.
Yeah.
I fully understood his perspective at the time. Because when you're working on a piece of true genius,
mm-hmm.
no one fucking knows it is.
No.
It's not out yet.
Yeah, of course.
And 99% of the time, it's fucking not.
Yeah. 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 But luckily, Pet Sounds went on to be one of the
best fucking albums of all time. It did, but I was very happy to see the admission by the filmmakers and sort of implicitly by Brian Wilson.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that was a bit much to ask people to go along with.
100%. Yeah.
And it's one of the elements of this film that stops it becoming a sugar-coated hagiography of a genius man.
He talks about it all the time. He says that his brothers, like, you know, like Carl Wilson, for example, was incredibly proud of Pet Sounds, but Mike Love, his cousin, was incredibly dubious because he was like, I'm not sure that people are going to like this.
Yeah.
And he was right.
He was right. It flopped.
It did flop, yeah.
It went on to become incredibly...
Yeah.
Like, people always talk about Kid A by Radiohead as like... Oh, it's genius. It lost 90% of their fan base.
Yeah.
It was only because it was so good that they got 90% of that back with new people.
They just switched them out, which is great. It's all a great thing to do. The main thing that I have with biopics is the structure of them. It's normally, you know, sort of like initial beginnings, it's rise to fame, then superhero it's struggle,
origin stories.
Then it's fall off, then it's sort of like the ultimate redemption.
It's Joseph Campbell's Hero of a Thousand Faces, but slapped on a human life.
Exactly. But this doesn't do that. No. This is like, it stays painfully honest to what actually happened, where it was huge pressure of being a musical genius in the 60s, horrible crash out in the 70s, massive mess, everyone, no one knows what the fuck's going on.
Mm-hmm.
80s, try and recover from mental illness and figure out where the fuck you stand with everything now. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
The ending of this film is so fucking perfectly done. It's unreal. It is unreal. Because if it had gone on to actually do the whole real ending, you know, like a full life of love, happiness, it wouldn't have been believable. You just see the very spark.
The very start of it.
That sort of brings him back from an edge that seemed impossible to leave.
The last frame of this film, him and his Melinda chatting as they get back in the car, but it mutes the audio of what he's saying because it's not for
it's
us.
It's not important. It's not for them. Us. Yeah.
That's their business, not ours. Yeah. I sorely love that. Okay, right. Before you get too sad, I've got a suggestion.
Okay.
Have you considered...
Mm-hmm.
With Brian Wilson, manning up.
I mean,
hear me out, because I did my playground time in the 90s. We spoke about this, right?
Yeah.
When wearing the wrong socks was gay.
Oh, yeah. Right? You wear sandals and socks at playground, you're going to get bullied for 5 years.
Sandals, mate, wrong colour socks was gay, right?
Yeah.
The wrong brand of trainers, gay.
I'm sorry, are they Gola?
Right.
Gayler.
Did you just feel a feeling? Gay.
Gay.
And as I've grown... Mm-hmm. You know, I've embraced that philosophy.
Same.
And it hasn't led me out of hotel windows in mad panics.
Sure.
It's always been helpful. I do 30 push-ups a week.
Right.
I shout no homo after each one.
Mm-hmm.
And I just think you need to embrace this philosophy, mate.
Yeah.
You like women. They're soft. They're gentle.
Sure.
Arguably very gay of you to like them. Get fucked in the ass like a real man.
Yeah. All right.
Right? Man up.
I'll man up. Yeah.
Just bottle it down.
Yeah.
Just push it
just
down.
Just crack on. Yeah.
Just crack on.
All right.
I mean, I know you tried it before and it failed miserably.
Yeah.
But men don't quit, mate.
Yeah.
Quitting's gay.
Yeah. I see that.
With your zin.
I can see that. I have just quit vaping. So, you know, that is pretty gay of me.
Do you know how much that's annoyed me?
Why?
Because I can't do it.
Yeah, you can.
I know I can, but...
Well, I'm eating like 9 of these a day. Like, I'm not even joking. I fell asleep with one in last night. I woke up 4 hours later and my mouth is fine. It should have melted my gums clean
off. I was going to say, if I'd fallen asleep with a zin in, I think I'd probably fall asleep with 4 in and I'd wake up looking like an extra from The Walking Dead.
Yeah.
Just...
Yeah.
Or like Imhotep from The Mummy before he's fully cooked.
Yeah. Well, there you go, man. That's it. All right, I'll try manning up.
Man up. Look, it's an accurate biopic.
Massively. Do you want to know how accurate?
I mean, yes, I do. Because I, again, haven't researched this. Research is gay, and I don't do that.
I really struggled with the research on this. Everything that I tried to do has just made me fucking tear up. I tried reading a little bit of work. I work in a cinema. Obviously, I'm sitting there.
Mm-hmm.
Film's just gone in. I'm like, I'll just get a quick paragraph in.
Yeah.
It's just sort of like, oh, Brian Wilson's relationship with his brothers, and I have to shut my laptop and go do something else, like clean the coffee machine or...
Right, yeah.
Can't be doing this. How was Mission Impossible 8?
You see?
How was that?
Not only is research gay, but it sounds like research makes you gay.
I mean, in all fairness.
I mean, I say this with nail polish on my hands.
Researching this has been so fucking hard because everyone is so lovely.
Mm-hmm.
Everyone involved in this film. You watch interviews, man. there's like panels where there's Brian Wilson's on the stage, Bill Pollard is on the stage, mm-hmm. the fucking John Cusack, Paul Dano, Elizabeth Banks, Atticus Ross, who did the soundtrack for this.
Which is insane to me, because for those of you that don't know, I used to work in the music industry, and a big part of that was because I was a massive Nine Inch Nails fan,
yeah.
which is primarily Trent Reznor for almost all of his career. He's never let anyone else in the band. The only guy he's let in the band
yeah.
was a couple of years ago. He said, all right, Atticus Ross is actually in the band.
Yeah, yeah.
I'm seeing him on stage at the O2 Arena in 48 hours.
Yeah, yeah.
And he did the soundtrack to Love and Mercy, the Brian Wilson film.
He did.
Which is mental.
I've got a little bit from him here because I knew that you'd appreciate this. So
I do get wet for Nin.
I know. So when asked to be involved with Love and Mercy,
right.
Atticus Ross immediately said no. He was like, and this is a quote from him, I said, absolutely no. No right. way. How can you possibly compete? Well, not compete, but how do you...
compare.
You're going to play a bit of a song and then slip it into a score and it'll be lame as fuck, in my opinion. I'm also not a fan of the music biopic genre.
Right.
But it was only when I read the script and understood what the film was, mm-hmm. and then I thought the film will still be a massive challenge.
Yeah.
So that's Atticus Ross, who was Giga sitting Chad. On stage with Brian Wilson. When asked about the soundtrack of this film, he was like, no, didn't want to do it. Not at all. Didn't want to do it at all. Thought it was going to be lame as fuck, to be honest.
It does feel a little bit like getting into a dick swinging contest with an elephant at that point.
You just,
do you want to do the music on a film? Yeah, all right. About who? Brian Wilson. Yeah. All right.
Oh, so you've done a good deed. Yeah, I helped an old woman across the street. Brilliant. Here is literal Jesus sitting next to you. But then when Atticus Ross is speaking, there's a little glimmer. It's like it just cuts to like a wide panel of this whole thing where everyone has like a little laugh and a joke when Atticus is like, I didn't want to do it because what the fuck are we doing? And it's like the first and only time I've ever seen Brian Wilson sort of applaud someone else. And I was like, oh, I saw it. I think it.
Because there's going to be that camaraderie, right? Of like,
100%.
He's going to understand how yeah. that feels.
But he's also going to look at it and go, fucking fair play, man. Because yeah. you're right.
I think
most people would have just done a bit of a song and right. then it slip into a score and gone, good enough.
Whereas Atticus has taken the entire back catalogue and smashed it together. There's a fantastic scene towards the end of the movie, which I'm going to come back to.
Yeah.
In a minute when we wrap up, because we're running short on time. But
yeah, yeah.
there's a scene where Brian Wilson's lying in bed sort of going through his life. And yeah. the audio is just this wonderful... It's a cacophony and it's a montage and it's a smashing together of all the songs across his career, but in such a way that it becomes its own thing. It becomes yeah, yeah, its yeah. own song, but it's not a song. It's noise and it's soundtrack and it's
yeah.
corruption and it's, oh,
everything
it's an objectively a new artistic statement.
Yeah.
Without at any point Atticus's creativity being at the forefront.
Exactly.
It's a new creative statement with Brian Wilson, about Brian Wilson, for Brian Wilson. And fuck me, that's a line to walk.
Listen, the balls of steel on that guy to go, yeah, I'll do the music for the Beach Boys right. movie. Seems like a throwaway statement. When you're sat next to Brian Wilson, and Brian Wilson and his more importantly, his wife, Melinda Ledbetter.
Who will beat the shit out
who
of you.
Was, she was involved in the production of the film to make sure that everything was right. The yep. latter part of this film, like the 80s scenes,
yep.
are all written from stories that Melinda told Aaron. She told him all these memories and was just sort of like, you know the scene where they jump off the boat and they go swimming?
Yep.
Really happened. They just jumped off the boat.
Gorgeous.
Went for a swim, went back to his house and just hung out. That was one of the dates. That's like one of her fun memories. The scene in the restaurant where he starts going into his abuse and she sort of asks the bodyguard and the double date to just yeah, give him a bit of space.
Well, the minder who's kept there at all times yeah. because Eugene Levy needs to make sure yeah. that nothing happens to Brian that he isn't made aware of.
There's I've been looking into this whole thing. I went down a Eugene Landy fucking rabbit hole.
Right.
$430,000 a year he was charging for Oi. His services to look after Brian with his security detail and all of this bullshit. It's fucked. The whole thing is fucked. Sorry. I had to get that out.
I think for me, the moment that really exposes Eugene Landy to me mm-hmm. is when Melinda comes around and he immediately is like, go on dates with Brian. That's brilliant.
Mm.
But when you finish them, I want you to prepare a report of everything that he said, everything that he thinks,
everything
he spoke about.
Yeah.
Call me immediately. And I'm mm-hmm. like, oh, mm-hmm. oh, that's just like to
frames
need
it
that,
as the betterment for Brian's well-being, right, as well, as but, if like trying to play on her emotions,
but to need that around a person, to not allow them the space to exist unobserved by you.
Yes.
Evocative, let's put it that way.
It's honestly, mate, but the way that this film is like portrayed in the way that it's done, this is Melinda Ledbetter. This film is like his music. It's made for anyone that cares about love.
Cheer up, babe. I'll get you hot chocolate.
Okay, yeah, go, yeah,
do you want some more cocoa?
I got it. Ready?
Some more cocoa? Some cocoa, Mo?
It's Melinda. It's fine. This film is like his music. It's made for anybody that cares about love, that cares about the struggles people go through to achieve their goals.
Yep.
You're going to have to do this.
Okay.
You're going to have to do this. It's this bit here. I'm going to highlight it.
Highlight it and I'll read it out.
Yeah, there you go. You're going to have to do this. Fucking hell. There you go.
This film, according to Melinda, is like his music. It's made for anybody that cares about love, that cares about the struggles people go through to achieve their goals. Love is timeless. Great music is timeless. Love can conquer everything. In Brian's story, it did. He found it. We found it. So I'm gonna skip ahead here because there's a section that is entirely related to what that has just said. And I've been bullying you all episode about manning up and trying to get you away from this with rage bubbles, but I think it's important that you know and the listeners know. I was never a big Beach Boys fan, and they just weren't part of my upbringing or anything like this. They were for you. Brian Wilson was a necessary lifeline and a kind of lighthouse through stormy waters.
Mm-hmm.
And the world is objectively worse without him. But the simple fact of the matter is that I will always love Brian Wilson and the Pet Shop Boys. Yeah, I will always love Brian Wilson.
All right, that snapped me out of it a little bit. That was good.
I will always love Brian Wilson and Pet Sounds and the Beach Boys because he gave you a love of music that led to you coming to Thames Valley University 18 years ago where you and I could meet. And God only knows what I'd be without you, all right?
Fuck you. Fuck you.
So, like, I'm grateful to Brian Wilson for helping you survive long enough that I could meet you and we could do this. Whether I like his songs or not, but I do because they're fucking mint.
Same. Fuck, man.
Take a minute, babe. We can edit.
This is insane. I'm 36.
Do you know what I love about it as well?
That fucking Footloose is playing in the street outside.
There was a moment where you were taking insane. A breath and it's just the sound. We're talking about like one of the all-time undisputable musical geniuses and there's a fucking GCSE music exhibition going on at the top of the road.
It's fucking amazing. It's so fitting. It's incredible. Oh, man. I am 36. I'm 36 years old. I am so fucking also same similar vein as you. Yeah, I'm snapping back.
It wasn't said in any need of anything being returned.
No, I know.
The fact of the matter is there are certain things, there are certain loves that you can have in your life that you weave through your life and will always be a thread there.
Yeah.
And I think what I'm trying to, what the kind of silver lining I'm trying to point at is that Brian Wilson, the person is gone, but the decisions and experiences and memories that he has given you and the ways that he has influenced your life will forever be true.
Oh, 1,000%.
Like, man. Without Pet Sounds, without Brian Wilson, you wouldn't have... I don't think you would have become a drummer. I don't think you would have gone on to have the love of music you do. And if you look at all the ways your life has unfolded and all the incredible things that have happened in your life... because of the love of music that he gave you.
Dude.
He's always going to be with you.
Beach Boys are a soundtrack for so many fucking memories. It's unreal. I was lucky enough to see him live 3 times, right? So I've seen Brian Wilson live twice. I've seen the Beach Boys live 3 times. So in Birmingham, that's the first time I saw him. That was at uni.
Oh, shit. I remember you going to that.
So that was the one where like
and me being like, weird.
Yeah.
Weird little 50s band.
You know what I mean?
My weird Japanese weeaboo mate who had more colours in his hair than the pride flag.
Right.
He was just walking around with fucking safety pins through his nipples. And just was like,
just one.
I'm gonna go see the Beach Boys. I'm like, if you'd said I'm gonna go see Perry Como, that was the same.
Yeah,
I was
What
is happening?
But the first time we saw him, it was me and my mate from college. We fucking got there. It was a seated down gig. We're the youngest by like 20 years. And we're dancing on the chairs because obviously it's the fucking Beach Boys, and everyone was sitting down, just sort of tapping their feet or whatever. So we were on our seats, like fucking dancing away. And some dude with like a, you know, the earpiece and a walkie talkie and shit comes over and is like, "Grab your shit and follow me." We were like, "Fuck's sake, are we getting kicked out of this? This is insane."
Out for being young.
So anyway, we grab our shit, follow him. He's leading us towards like the fire exit, and then takes a sharp left turn, and we end up side stage. And he's like, "Drop your shit there, right? You over by the bass player, you up by the keyboard."
Fuck off.
So she went out and danced with the bass player. Bass player put the guitar over her, started playing the bass like over. I danced next to the keyboard player. We were fucking having the time of our life. We were up there for two songs.
What?
It was literally the shit dreams are made of. It was insane.
It's bro, you were a little girl out of Trap.
Exactly. I was the fuck. That's what I'm saying.
What?
I was Josh Hartnett's daughter.
Oh my God. For two songs, you were Josh Hartnett's daughter.
Yeah, and I didn't have to lie about having leukemia either. You know what I mean?
Oh, mate.
It was just pure dancing. The one bit that I'm going to remember forever is the fucking Manchester gig, man. I was front row, and it's just a grand piano and Brian Wilson. He plays God Only Knows.
Mm-hmm.
Fucking gorgeous.
Mm-hmm.
And it is literally like, you know when the lights come back up and you're like, that just really happened?
Yeah.
That just really happened. Like, pure musical history, like, right there. Never again.
Mine are different. So I'm seeing Nine Inch Nails in 48 hours. And one of my favorite memories is when he got halfway through Hurt and someone shouted, "We love you, Trent." So he picked up the mic stand and threw it like a javelin at their face.
Yeah, that's better. That's a better way to handle it. You know what I mean? So this whole fucking episode has been like, it's been a shit show, and I'm sorry, because it's hard to research.
A necessary shit show.
Yeah. But it's been quite nice to sort of dip into this. You know what I mean?
It's actually really helpful because it's covered a bunch of stuff that when we cover Annihilation next week is going to be really relevant. And we're recording Annihilation soon enough that you're going to be in the same headspace. So.
Yeah, we're recording it tomorrow. So sick. Looking forward to this. All right. So two weepy weeks. That's going to be fun. So what's the film really mean? Let's get into the last bit. What's the film really mean? Come on.
Yep.
I can get through.
This is all you.
No.
Yeah.
No. What's your final takeaway? Give me your final takeaway.
Okay, well, I'll spoil next week a little bit. And it all comes down to the scene where he's on his bed and he's in bits. I think sometimes if life goes downhill, and I definitely did this, I don't know if I've ever mentioned this, but I used to work in the music industry.
I don't think you have, no.
And when I did, it was a lifelong dream. I'd like 14-year-old me decided he wanted to live in the music industry, work in the music industry, and help be the midwife to the next Pet Sounds.
Yeah.
I couldn't be its mother. Mm-hmm. I knew I didn't have those ideas.
Yeah.
I knew I didn't have that confidence. I didn't have that vision. But if I could be in the room and help somebody who had a Pet Sounds and be the person there to be like, "You got this. And don't worry, I'll take away all the complex bits and I'll do the stuff that you don't understand so you can shine." That's what I wanted to be. And I ended up 32 working on fucking mumble rap by people who didn't have... Well, literally, there was one session with a very famous American rapper who was saying what he saw on the television that was on mute. What had happened is I was hanging on to versions of myself and parts of myself that I really valued. I was like, no, this is who I am. This is what I do. This is when I was most applauded. I'm sound engineer to Chase and Status and Plan B, and I'm working with Pendulum and all this kind of stuff. And I wasn't. I was recording a KSI album.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean?
That turned out great.
Didn't it? I mean, it's one of my five platinum records is a KSI album.
Fucking
the other
hell.
One's a Little Mix album.
Yeah.
I got a few of them.
Yeah.
So I was hanging on to an idea of what I wanted to be and an idea of who I was that was not helpful.
Right.
What the breakdown allowed me to do was go, well, it's all in pieces now.
Mm-hmm.
I am at the bottom. So I've got nothing to lose.
Yeah.
What can I... And now I can afford to let go of a whole bunch of stuff because it doesn't get worse than this.
Yeah.
So anything I leave behind, I'm not really losing anything.
Yeah.
For me, this film is kind of about the production process of Pet Sounds and going, okay, I'm going to take these things that have never been put together before.
Yeah.
It's kind of the production process of latter day Brian Wilson.
Mm.
That's for me what it's really about.
Yeah.
How about you? Shall we try and finish the sentence, babe? You've got this.
I've got to keep it so fucking short, though. I think the film is really about love conquering all.
Yep.
And if that isn't the fucking truth, that it doesn't matter how low you go, how deep the fucking hole gets. There's just always that moment where you can forgive yourself at any point.
And I think that ties into the thing we were saying earlier about how can he be so nice about Eugene Landy? It's because in order to heal, you have to forgive.
Yeah.
Not only others, but yourself.
But yourself.
That is a very good wrap up. And I think it's the most we're going to get out of you at the moment because you are a weepy, weepy mess.
I'm 36, man. I need you to know that I am 36 and I'm out in the world just being a person. This is insane.
Fortunately, we're going to move to Comment Corner.
Oh, yeah, let's do that.
Because our number one top all-time listeners, Ross Grant, has got a rage bubble ready for you. And it's that...
Hit me with it.
He thinks Mad Max Fury Road is better than Ex Machina.
I fucking saw this. Right. In what universe does Tom Hardy being driven down the road equate to one of the greatest AI sci-fi commentaries on religion, humanity, like all this stuff?
Okay, I'm going to fight Ross's corner because okay. I think they're tied. I do think they're tied.
How?
Because there is more to a film than the script and the subtext.
100%.
And if Mad Max Fury Road is a masterclass in anything, it's the daredevil of movies.
Okay.
It's lost one sense, so all the others are mint.
Yeah.
It doesn't have a script. It doesn't have subtext.
Yeah, yeah.
So everything else is brought front and center. There's 100%. An incredible thing they do where every single time the camera cuts,
yeah,
whatever your eye was looking at
yeah.
in the frame, your eye doesn't have to move.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
So if he moves his hand to the right-hand side of the frame and then it cuts to the next shot,
your
what
eyes
you need
already
to look
on the right-hand side of the
is
frame.
It's already on the right-hand side of the frame.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
It is a masterclass of filmmaking and energy and pace.
1,000%.
And it is the least thinky film ever released.
100%.
And I love it for it. People say I've got posh film taste and everything I like is books, I'm like, one of my favorite films is Mad Max Fury Road.
Yeah,
precisely
it's
because it's not that.
It makes no sense to me.
It's mint. It's a mint film. And I can't say it's better. But I can say it ties. I really can.
I'll agree. It's the opposite end of the spectrum, but it's yeah. up there. It also cost a shitload more money. Just going to put that one in there.
Yeah, okay. Yeah, yeah. You're not wrong. You're not wrong.
I've got one here from the same reel on TikTok.
Oh, okay.
From a user called Spaghetti.
Oh,
right.
Top tier username.
Right.
They must have been so early on the platform to get that.
Just Spaghetti.
Just Spaghetti. Not Spaghetti 99.
Yeah.
Not Spaghetti 28453. No. Spaghetti.
Just Spaghetti.
Round of applause. So
in this reel, you've got your phone out, and my comment is, are you on your fucking phone?
Mm-hmm.
Then you give me a fact, and then I tell you to get off your phone so we yep. can watch the fucking film that we're watching. Yep. Right, so Spaghetti says, phones out during a film is only acceptable if you're on the IMDb page for that film.
Okay, yeah. Now I need to come clean here.
Go.
I lied a little bit.
Go on.
For the sake of making the reel make sense, I said that's all I was doing and it's acceptable. You know, mm-hmm. I physically am disgusted by the idea that somebody would find out something about that's about to happen in the film.
Yeah.
Before the film tells you.
Yeah. It's the and shit so, nightmares and, are made of.
Right.
I found out right. during a film is unacceptable.
So while I may have
re-watch.
Said in that comment, Spaghetti, mm-hmm. that's all I was doing, what you were watching was a carefully staged bit of theatre.
Right.
In order to demonstrate, so we could get the fact.
Right.
The idea that I'm on a phone during a film.
Yeah.
Violently wrong.
Good.
We agree on that fact.
Good.
But how else do we deliver a fact in a 30 second?
Fuck knows.
Right, exactly.
But I've been in the cinema before where
what?
People get their phone out and just start texting and I don't know what it is. Like, rage inducing isn't it. It's friendship ending. Like, I will never look at that person the same way ever again.
What are you rating Love and Mercy, Ben?
It's a fat 10, man. It's about the person that was a bigger part of my life than my biological father.
Yeah.
And every bit of wisdom that I've ever learned about life has come from records that he was
yeah
credited as writing.
I think that's fair. I think
and
that's
sort
fair.
Of I owe him
what else could
everything,
it
everything you know yeah. what I mean. Fat 10.
Nice.
You?
I'm gonna go with a 4. I think the songs are a bit twee.
Mm.
I don't really like the guy.
Mm. I hope Nine Inch Nails cancel. I hope you get to London, you get to the doors and they're like, oh, no, Trent's got a headache. Yeah, that's what it is. I hope that you're at the front row and he throws a fucking javelin, throws a mic stand at your face.
Obviously, I'm joking. It's a fat 10. It's a really good film. I think for somebody who's not had a parasocial care relationship with Brian Wilson, it's a fascinating film about a fascinating time in music and the world. And it has a lot to say about self-care and making sure that you look after one another. It's a wonderful little film. The performances are incredible. The cinematography is incredible. The soundtrack is fucking mint. You owe it to yourself to see this movie. We've spoiled nothing because it's about a real life.
Love conquers all, man.
Love conquers all, babe. And that is it. That's the end of the show.
Yeah, I'm afraid.
We love you all dearly.
We really do.
Thank you for hanging out with us and thank you for the support. It means the fucking world.
It really does. Go fucking tell your mates.
Do
you want to listen to a 36-year-old in our bed cry about Brian Wilson getting on this?
Actually crying as well.
Oh, shut up, man. I'm still teetering.
Like a baby.
Anyway.
Like a gay baby. Like a gaby.
Join the Discord. Get out on the social medias. Drop a comment. We'll, if it's funny, if it's insulting, if it's whatever it is, you might make comment corner. You know what I mean? And we'll let you know if you do. But I guess join us next week for normal programming and I'll try
We'll see, because it's Annihilation. I'm going to break you.
Yeah,
but to thank you for spending an hour of your week with us, especially at the start of the week. We know a lot of you listen on a Monday. Ben is going to wrap up the thoughts, themes, and feelings of Brian Wilson.
How do I do this?
A man who has provided him a constant source of comfort and joy and hope through a difficult, tumultuous period in his life, who is now dead. He's graveyard dead and will never be back. While I just tell you to consume.
I've got no fucking clue for this one, buddy. Like, there is nothing that I can say here that Brian Wilson hasn't summed up in absolute sheer perfection. I mean, listen to the fucking song Love and Mercy. Listen Until I Die. Listen to the album Surf's Up, man. Like, there's too much there. Like, he is just a fucking wizard. A lyrical wizard that does nothing but love and show love. What do we do?